Gaetz, the biggest firebrand inside of the House of Representatives.
You're not taking Matt Gaetz off the board, okay? Because Matt Gaetz is an American patriot and Matt Gaetz is an American hero.
We will not continue to allow the Uniparty to run this town without a fight.
I want to thank you, Matt Gaetz, for holding the line.
Matt Gaetz is a courageous man. If we had hundreds of Matt Gaetz in D.C., the country turns around. It's that simple.
He's so tough. He's so strong. He's smart, and he loves this country. Matt Gaetz.
It is the honor of my life to fight alongside each and every one of you. We will save America. It's choose your fighter time. Send in the firebrands.
One of life's most underappreciated talents is to know when it's time to move on to life's next chapter. So I stand before you today, Mr. President, and my colleagues, to say this will be my last term as Republican leader of the Senate. I'm not going anywhere anytime soon. However, I'll complete my job my colleagues have given me until we select a new leader in November and they take the helm next January. I'll finish the job the people of Kentucky hired me to do as well, albeit from a different seat. And I'm actually looking forward to that.
Welcome back to Firebrand. We are live. Thank you so much for joining us. We are simulcast streaming out of room 2021 of the Rayburn House office building here at the Capitol Complex in Washington, D.C. A lot going on Capitol Hill today. We had Secretary Lloyd Austin before the Armed Services Committee. Our exchange got a lot of attention online and throughout the halls of the Pentagon and Congress. And we also had debate on a continuing resolution that ultimately passed. That's deeply disappointing, continues our nation's march toward decline. But that was the farewell speech of the Republican leader in the United States Senate, Mitch McConnell. And I guess we can say RIP to the leadership tenure of Mitch McConnell in the Senate. Mitch McConnell has finally encountered a situation that he cannot manipulate. Time. Many Republicans are quick to preach Mitch McConnell into heaven, citing his procedural victories like confirming Trump's judicial nominees and passing the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. That was a policy win. And I say, fair enough. I suppose if you've been in the Senate since 1985, you probably know your way around some of these matters. Call me crazy. I think that's doing the bare minimum as a Republican leader. Mitch McConnell's real legacy is that he was missing in action when we needed him most and spent a lot of his time in the Senate putting special interests above American interests. Real good at sloshing that special interest money around. Totally different question, leading us to the policy choices that are necessary. Now, McConnell spared no expense ramming through billions and billions of dollars for Ukraine without so much as a plan of action or a definition of victory. Seems to be for a lot of the wars in the absence of some clear, definable objective. So where was Mitch McConnell when our own borders were being overrun? And frankly, where is he now? Last time we saw him work on a legislative product, it was the Lankford Amnesty Bill. It was backstabbing to the people who want a secure border. Fortunately, we put that to death. Now, McConnell justifies Ukraine aid in perpetuity because the vast majority of the money is going to American defense contractors, according to his argument. Now, I don't even know if that's true, but how unmasking regarding the influence that the military-industrial complex has, particularly over the legislative leadership? Where was Mitch McConnell when American patriots were being rounded up by a corrupt FBI for petty misdemeanors involving January 6th protests? He was criticizing President Trump, actually, and he was pointing the finger at Republican voters. Now, we are lucky enough that Father Time isn't the only entity opposing Mitch McConnell. Republican voters and America First senators and representatives, we've all been fighting him when he abandons Republican principles. And without that work, Mitch McConnell would have probably been okay impeaching Donald Trump, and he'd still be working to defend Ukraine's borders at the expense of our own. Mitch knows this. It's why he undermined America First Senate candidates throughout his tenure as leader. And there's a reason Mitch is leaving this post in November. He doesn't want a new Republican Senate majority in January to elect a new leader. So he's going out like he came in, dancing with the one who brung him the swamp. That's who Mitch McConnell served. So the writing is on the wall. Time for new conservative leadership in the Senate. And really, I was talking to some senators today. It's about what the Senate intends to actually do. What are the goals of the Senate? What is the battle plan? And if you can get our Republican majority to agree on that, the leadership questions actually fall into place quite nicely. Now, it's time for leadership in the Senate that reflects the will of the American people, the voters who send them there, and those who will work with President Trump, I think will be the ones who ought to rise to the top. I don't know. It's a pretty swampy system over there. Swampiest nursing home in America. At this stage of the game, we've ousted McCarthy, McDaniel, and now McConnell. And my advice going forward is that the Republican leadership doesn't need to pick one of the Johns. John Thune, John Cornyn, John Barrasso, they are all expected to make runs for leader. Cornyn already announcing that he's the current whip. And I think that there are going to be better options than the Johns, and I look forward to seeing those emerge very quickly. So, also wanted to update you on the Hunter Biden deposition that occurred this week. I gave my perspective walking out. Take a listen. There were a number of interesting moments, but perhaps none more interesting than when Hunter Biden told us that he joined the Burisma board to counter Russian aggression. I hadn't heard that one before, that thank goodness we had Hunter Biden on the Burisma board because that was central to his strategy to stand up to Vladimir Putin.
Has he taken the fifth at all?
No, he's been responsive to questions.
Has he told you exactly what value he brought to any of these wards, any of these companies yet? Have you guys asked him that?
Yeah, we've asked those questions, and there is an illusory value. It is a mirage to believe that Hunter Biden was engaged in international business. This was a bribe masquerading as an international business transaction.
Have you seen evidence that the president was involved in those business dealings yet?
I believe that you can actually bribe someone by paying their family members. Like, I don't get this construct that unless Joe Biden himself received cash, that he somehow wasn't involved in the bribery operation. Joe Biden was doing the bidding of Burisma. He was doing the bidding of Chinese communists, and his family was getting enriched as a consequence. To me, that's a pretty strong case for bribery. We're back live, and I'm going through my notes from the Hunter Biden deposition, and let me distill all of it for you. So if Hunter Biden was getting paid, right, if there were wire transfers coming in from foreign oligarchs, foreign companies, corrupt foreign businesses, well, that money was coming to him because he is a brilliant lawyer and a financial wizard and a connector man about town in Washington and was just a high-performing, awesome guy who deserved every bit of the millions from China, the $1 million a year to serve on the Burisma board. He was earning that money due to his merit, competence, diligence, and focus. But if he was asking for money, and remember, when he was asking for money, that's when you saw the threats, the shakedowns, the references to his father. That's when you saw the money laundering. If he was asking for money, he was just a drug-addled fool. So getting paid, highly competent, effective, trying to get paid, well, you know, that was the crack talking. And so I asked Hunter Biden, and you'll see the transcript released either tonight or pretty soon tomorrow. When are we supposed to know in these messages that you're sending and in these correspondence that you're engaged in when you're high and when you're not? And he said, for me to even ask that question means I don't understand the fundamentals of addiction and that he ought to be able to absolve himself of any connection to the truth if he claims he was high. But if he was getting paid, we're all just supposed to believe that wasn't a bribe. But indeed, we know it was. And while I don't believe this is going to manifest in some sort of impeachment of Joe Biden on these bribery charges in the House of Representatives, that is because there is a difference of opinion among some Republicans as to what constitutes a bribe. Again, to me, as I just said in that clip, if you want to influence some guy in their like 70s or 80s, giving them the cash isn't necessarily the best way to even bribe them. In a lot of cases, they're thinking that a lot of that money is going to end up going to the government in some sort of estate tax. And so the movement of money to people's family members and children to try to shape their actions in government is like clearly a bribe to me. It's so clear. We put it in the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. Now, the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, that governs what Americans can do to try to shape governmental decisions elsewhere. And so we say to our own citizens, you can't go bribe someone's crack-addicted kid or their ne'er-do-well spouse. You can't go pay them to get a government official abroad to alter their behavior. But we allow that here, apparently. Or we may without an impeachment, because we have some Republicans who, if the money isn't going directly to Joe, they're not going to be there on the vote. So I'm telling you the truth. He deserves impeachment. These were bribes, but they were bribes through family members. And that threshold is going to be insufficient for some of my Republican colleagues. And we will, of course, get no Democrat votes on these questions. Today in the House Armed Services Committee, we had Secretary Lloyd Austin. Now, you'll remember some time ago, Lloyd Austin just went AWOL and didn't tell the President of the United States or really even the broader national security apparatus of his incapacitation, because some cancer treatment that he had received had gone poorly. He was bleeding. He goes to the hospital. He's incapacitated. His military aides around him, with no civilian oversight, transfer his authorities to the deputy. He wasn't even involved in that decision. And we had him before the House Armed Services Committee today to answer questions. Here's Armed Services Chairman Mike Rogers framing up the issue quite nicely.
Mr. Secretary, the reason we've asked you here today is not to discuss your health. We're here to here today to determine why the President was not immediately informed of your incapacitation. The timeline, as we understand it, is this. On the evening of January 1st, Secretary Austin was transported to the hospital via ambulance for complications stemming from a surgical procedure he had on December 22nd. On the afternoon of January 2nd, the Secretary's authorities were transferred to Deputy Secretary Hicks without her even being informed as to why. On January 4th, 3 days after the Secretary's hospitalization, Deputy Secretary Hicks and the President were first informed that Secretary Austin was in the hospital. On January 5th, Congress is informed of the Secretary's hospitalization. It's totally unacceptable that it took 3 days to inform the President of the United States that the Secretary of Defense was in the hospital and not in control of the Pentagon. Wars were raging in Ukraine and Israel. Our ships were under fire in the Red Sea, and our bases were bracing for attack in Syria and Iraq. But the Commander-in-Chief did not know that his Secretary of Defense was out of action. Even the Deputy Secretary, the person to whom your powers were transferred, didn't know that you were in the hospital. Our forces conducted a pre-authorized strike on Iranian-backed militia in Iraq during this period. Had something gone wrong with the strike, or worse, if there was an attack on the United States, precious time would have been wasted while the President sought in vain to find his Secretary of Defense. The chain of command doesn't work when the Commander-in-Chief doesn't know who to call. That's why we want to know who made the decision to withhold that information from the President. And although you publicly stated you are solely responsible, you've also informed this committee that it wasn't you who decided to withhold the information from the President. We were led to believe your 30-day interval internal review would shed light on that matter. But it includes no explanation of why the President and his staff were left in the dark. It makes no recommendations to improve communication with the White House. And unsurprisingly, it holds nobody accountable. We appreciate your desire to protect your subordinates, but it's important in democracy that public officials are held accountable when mistakes are made. This administration has gone to great lengths to avoid accountability whenever possible. But this is a matter of national security, and someone needs to be held accountable. Furthermore, I find it very concerning that the secretary could be hospitalized for 3 days without anyone else in the administration even noticing. That suggests Secretary Austin's advice is not sought or heeded in the White House, even while military operations were ongoing in the Middle East. It also implies that the White House politicals, not seasoned defense professionals, are in the driver's seat on matters of national security, which is very disturbing. Finally, beyond the immediate need to inform the president, Congress also has a right to know of secretarial absence or transfer of authority. Ironically enough, none of this would have come to the attention if the White House hadn't demanded that the department come clean to Congress and the public. Ultimately, our goal today is to understand how and why this happened so we can ensure it never happens again.
We're back live. Jim on Facebook says he's a Trump supporter and we need to leave Lloyd Austin alone. He's battling cancer. There was no harm. We should have just had a quick meeting and dealt with it that way in the absence of bringing in for this testimony. And I'm going to explain why I took a different tack than Jim on Facebook might suggest. So my staff pulls up for me this memo that Lloyd Austin writes March 4th, 2021. And it sets up the questions that I'm going to ask Lloyd Austin, that I'll show you in just a moment. And it says in this memo, DOD leaders at every level will be responsible for building a safe environment for our people and guaranteeing that we show swift and clear accountability to anyone who does not act within the highest standards of the department. And so while I hope Lloyd Austin is successful in his battle against cancer, and I'm not overly nosy about people's private health circumstances, there was a hypocrisy here regarding Lloyd Austin's actions that have destroyed lives, careers, families, marriages. In my community in Florida One, there was a hypocrisy that I had to point out. Take a listen.
You didn't tell the president that you had cancer, that you were being treated for cancer, or that the treatment for that cancer had gone wrong because you saw it as personal and medical. And I think a lot of us have empathy for you in that regard. But now that you see how personal medical decisions are, will you call for the re-recruitment, restoration of full rank and back pay for the 8,600 service members who were vax mandated out of the military?
No, I won't.
So on March 4th, 2021, you authored a memo. It was entitled Message to the Force. And in that memo, you said that there would be clear and swift accountability for anyone who didn't meet the highest standards of the Department of Defense. Now, however this worked out, we all acknowledge that what you did here didn't meet the highest standards, right? You made a mistake.
I admit it too.
Yeah, okay, so we got that. So then the question is, what becomes the clear and swift accountability? Now, you're not going to be discharged, right? No?
That's right.
Okay, you're not going to be suspended. You're not going to be demoted, and you're not going to have your pay cut. None of those things are going to happen to you, right?
That's right.
Okay, so you come here seeking some grace and some forgiveness. And I want you to know that one of the service members who you vax mandated out of the military sent me the parable of the unforgiving debtor. And it's in the book of Matthew. It's verses 21 to 35. The man fell down before his king and begged him, "Please be patient with me, and I will pay all the debt." Then his master, filled with pity for him, released him and forgave him of his debt. But when the man left the king, he went to a fellow servant who owed him a few thousand dollars. He grabbed him by the throat and demanded payment. His fellow servant sat down and begged him for a little more time. "Be patient with me, and I will pay it," he pleaded. But his creditor would not wait. He had the man arrested and put in prison until the debt could be paid in full. When some of the other servants saw this, they were very upset. They went to the king and told him everything that had happened. And the king called the man who had been forgiven and said, "You evil servant, I forgave you that tremendous debt because you pleaded with me. Shouldn't you have mercy on your fellow servant just as I had mercy on you?" Then the angry king sent the man to prison to be tortured until he had paid his entire debt. Mr. Secretary, you come to us seeking forgiveness, but you offer none. And it seems as though the pattern is repeated. You make a mistake, like on the vax mandate and here regarding your notification, then you get busted. President Biden had to sign something into law reversing your vax mandate. You got busted here, not because you came forward, but because we learned of this through other means. And then after you get busted making a mistake, you know, you want that benefit, but you don't want to extend it to others. This isn't swift or clear. You're not meeting your own standards that you set for yourself. And you say that the DOD is a learning organization. Haven't you learned yet that the military is weaker, not stronger, with the 8,600 people that you vax mandated out of the military?
Just one point, Congressman. The reason I'm here is because the chairman requested that I appear to talk about the circumstances surrounding my hospitalization.
But don't you see the hypocrisy in it? Because you screwed up, we fix your screw up, and now you want grace. But these people who sought religious exemptions, they got no such grace. And also, I just think it's ridiculous that we're in three wars. You went AWOL for 3 days, and we get 2 hours with you. If you can't spend more than 2 hours answering these questions, I don't know how you really operate in all these wars.
That was the House Armed Services Committee. We also had debate and vote on the floor regarding yet another continuing resolution. And frequent listeners to this program will know how much I loathe this. I loathe it to my bones. I know that the entire ecosystem that the corrupt swamp thrives off of demands that we just take one up or down vote on extending the funding of government or not. And that's why we put things in the rules, like 72-hour provision to review single subject. And you know what they did today? They passed a continuing resolution by suspending the rules, all of them. Just suspending the rules and putting it on the floor. And they were able to do it because the uniparty allowed it. Because the two-thirds, if you have two-thirds, if you have all the Democrats and a bunch of sellout Republicans, then you know what? You can do a whole lot. You can blow through the rules that we're trying to put in place. I debated against this continuing resolution on the floor today. Take a listen.
Watching House Republicans is like watching a football team whose best play is the punt and the block. Now, I've tried to throw a few Hail Marys along the way, and I'm glad that we blocked the bad Langford amnesty bill, but we punted on needed FISA reforms. We blocked the McConnell supplemental for now, but we punt yet again on needed spending cuts. We blocked additional aid and additional U.S. involvement in this war in Ukraine, and indeed we punted Kevin McCarthy, who authorized $115 billion to Ukraine. But here we gather to punt yet again. Last I checked, the Republicans actually have a majority in the House of Representatives, but you wouldn't know it if you looked at our checkbook, because we are all too willing to continue the policy choices of Joe Biden and the spending levels of Nancy Pelosi instead of showing the will and the courage to say that this woke and weaponized government has to be defanged. It has to be attacked. It has to see reductions in spending. And while many Americans have lived most of their lives not actually paying a price for the national debt, because we are $34 trillion in debt, because we are on our way to $50 trillion in debt, the Americans who work hard all over this country are seeing higher gas prices, higher grocery prices, higher interest rates, and all we seem to offer is low energy and low tea in the face of those mounting challenges. We ought to be rejecting this CR, we ought to pass single subject spending bills, and we ought to vote for the spending cuts that this country desperately needs. I yield back.
We're back live. We won that debate, but lost the vote overwhelmingly. I don't even think we got 100 Republicans voting against it, which, you know, when you got 200 plus, you have to start by getting a majority of the majority. And today, a majority of the majority voted for yet another continuing resolution, continuing the Pelosi-Biden spending levels, the Pelosi-Biden policy choices. People worked hard for this House majority, and we are not utilizing the leverage sufficient to meet the needs and to stop some of the just march to perdition that the Pelosi-Biden plan will take us down. There's been much discussion all over the country regarding the tragic death of Laken Riley. This is someone who was murdered by an illegal immigrant who never should have been in this country. I was moved when I saw the vigil today for Laken Riley and the outpouring of support from folks who understand that this loss of life is absolutely preventable. It's preventable if we stop the illegal immigration, and people are waking up to it. They're seeing in districts all over this country, from this community in Athens to my community, where on this podcast we covered our constituent who was murdered, well, who was killed on a motorcycle because an illegal immigrant was driving drunk, and that ended the life of someone who should still be with us today. It is ripening, this question. It is drawing from the deep amount of pain that the American people feel related to illegal immigration. And when the Athens Clark County mayor, Mayor Gertz, addressed this issue, he got a sense of some of that anger. Take a listen.
I've received many calls, many emails, many queries from the press in recent days about this notion of a sanctuary city. And so I want to lay some things to rest here today. This term sanctuary city doesn't have a sole legal or procedural definition. You can look in Georgia statute and you can find a clear definition for a unified government. You can look in contractual language and you can find out exactly what it means to be an SEC institution. Sanctuary city doesn't track with either of those. And so that term means different things to different people depending on the context of the discussion. We are here to listen.
Liar. You're a liar.
We are here to listen.
Liar.
There'll be time for questions.
You are guilty and got blood on your hands for this murder, sir.
Many of the aspects that are ascribed to sanctuary cities,
we know what sanctuary
are things that are disallowed by Georgia law.
Sanctuary policy, which is what we do.
And we contribute a document every year to the Georgia Department of Audits, indicating that we do not correspond to these definitions under state law.
Yes, you do.
And no policies have been adopted
Please
by the mayor
lying.
And commission You're that have created sanctuary
identity.
City status
Sir,
in Athens.
You need to resign.
One protocol
resign
that sometimes
now.
Arises.
Resign now.
You allowed protocol. This to happen, sir.
Yeah, it turns out people don't like it when you adopt sanctuary policies in drag. Like you had this mayor defending some of the worst impulses of local governments to put their own citizens at risk, and he got an earful from some of those very citizens. I want to give you an update now regarding some really bad stuff going on at the FCC. Now, you might not think daily about the Federal Communications Commission, but they have a really important role regulating America's airwaves and the entire information battle space that is so critical to get good decisions to the forefront in a representative republic. And we took note of a recent action by the FCC and the strong dissent from a conservative FCC commissioner, Brendan Carr. So Brendan Carr is objecting to this rule that the FCC has repeatedly tried to put into place that takes DEI policies to a dangerous extreme. And I'm reading now from the dissent of Commissioner Carr on the adoption of this rule. Today's FCC order takes two separate actions. First, it reinstates the federal requirement that broadcasters file a document every year with the FCC that lists the race and gender of their employees. In particular, the second part of today's order, the FCC decides that it will take this form with demographic data and publish it on a station-by-station basis, meaning that the FCC will now post a race and gender scorecard for every TV and radio broadcast station in the country. In doing so, the FCC caves to the demands of activist groups that have worked for years across different industries to persuade the federal government to obtain the most important to obtain this data and publish it. This type of data about individual businesses truly does not belong on the internet. And it's there as a precursor to the Chinese social credit score. They want to give the corporate social credit score to every TV broadcast station and every radio broadcast station and make them list the race and gender of their employees. this is crazy. This is not the public purpose of our airwaves, and we are incredibly proud of this dissent. The courts have struck down this attempted rule repeatedly, and we would encourage them to do so. Again, it's unconstitutional, un-American, and certainly deprives many Americans of like equal protection if they're running these broadcast stations and then being treated differently as a consequence of racial or gender-based makeup. The Vice President of the United States is always prone for some embarrassing comments that seem untethered from reality. We heard one such comment regarding students being paid to engage in politics by the government. Take a listen.
Under the Federal Work Study Program, now allows students to get paid through Federal Work Study to register people and to be nonpartisan poll workers. As we know, this is important for a number of reasons. One, to engage our young leaders in this process and activate them.
You know, it always worries me when people in the government are paying folks I just get the sense this is the modern incarnation of Acorn. You remember Acorn? When they went and used a bunch of public money, ran it through a bunch of private entities, and then they were trying to achieve a political outcome on the other end. And it's just got that kind of flavor of it to me. I'm often on Twitter Spaces. You can follow me at Matt Gaetz, and you'll be notified when we go on those. It's usually in the evening, and there were just a couple comments I want to close the show out with. Texas Trucker gave an update on Twitter Spaces regarding these boycotts of loads into and out of New York based on the crazy Letitia James effort to bankrupt President Trump, seize his assets, and deprive him of due process, and really any process when what he was doing yielded no victim. But the truckers have certainly reacted. Take a listen.
Talk to me about how this boycott of deliveries and pickups in New York City came to be. Like, how did you become aware of it? How did it come together? Give us a sense of how many people you think are participating and what the impact will be. Because it's very interesting.
Yes, sir. I can't tell you how many people are participating. Here's what I can tell you. I'm on the load board every day. I am a small carrier. I am an owner-operator. I'm on the road every day. I work every day. And I run specifically spot freight. This come out last week. There was a bunch of truckers in a truck stop talking, and Chicago One Ray come out with it. If you ain't following that account, follow his account. You have the real trucker Jake. You have the disrespected trucker Taylor Built, myself, and others that have been pushing this and putting information out that this is what we're doing. How big it gets, I don't know. I know we've had impact because I was sitting in Laredo, Texas on Thursday. And, you know, I key in on the load board because I run specifically spot freight, day of spot. Well, I'd been seeing loads to New York from Laredo running about $4,500 a load. Well, after this was announced and a couple of days in, I seen the rates jump from 4,500 to 6,500 a load. So you know you're having some impact. That you see that in supply and demand. The supply and demand affects the price of the loads. So I seen that, but also we have access to tools on our load boards to see how many trucks are posted in the area and how many loads are posted in the area. So when we started pushing this, what we seen in New York and specifically was it was a cold blue. It's got a scale that's blue to red, blue being cold, red being hot, of course. Well, when we, after a few days in, we started seeing New York go to an orange color, which means it's relatively hot. I seen 6,100 trucks there in New York area, and there was 28,000 loads. So that tells a tale. They can push back. They can do what they want to, but the tools we have and us being professionals out here about what we do and businessmen, we see it, and they can say what they want to. What we see is the truth because we're out here working. But, you know, we could use the help getting this out because it has not been walked back. We're moving on forward, and we're talking about D.C. as well and other places. I mean, you know, the truckers are tired. We're tired of it out here, man, and we have the power if we unite. to be able to be very impactful in this fight that we're all in. So y'all keep that in mind. I see my good friend Mr. Stevenson down there, Punch Bowl. I see Truth Not Fiction Mattered, my boy. Great space, man, and I'm gonna kick back, and if you got questions, I'll answer them. There's no way we can know right now how impactful this is going to be, but the louder we get and the more support we get for this, the more of an impact it will have, and I'll park it there. Thank y'all.
Thank you.
We love our truckers. We're proud of them. We appreciate their activism. Apple Acres on X says, if you can't define what a woman is, how can you list the gender? Good question. 411 True Solution on Getter says that quotas are anti-American. I fully agree with that. And Bruce on YouTube disagrees with Jim on Facebook, says Lloyd Austin undeniably has to be held accountable. Before we get out of here, I do want you to hear a little bit of the reaction we got from Florida One on X Spaces. Take a listen.
And the last thing I'll say, which I love you, Matt Gaetz, you don't know this, but I have a house in Pensacola. And I support you as much as I possibly can. I put my signs in my yard. I don't care if renters are living in my house. They always have a Matt Gaetz sign in front of it. So listen, what we really want and what we're really seeing is the exposure of who's on our side that isn't on our side. And it's happening. And that is what is most important to me, is really exposing the people that aren't on your side that act like they are.
Actually, this is the season for that. And first of all, thank you for the Pensacola love. Nothing matters more to me than the viewpoint of my true and actual bosses, the people I work for, the people who pay taxes here and pay my salary. So thank you for that.
Follow me at Matt Gaetz on X. And hey, you can ask a question directly when we get on the spaces. You'll get notification. Also, the best way to get notification regarding our Firebrand updates, download the Rumble app, turn the notifications on, allow that push notification to come through. You'll get the very first update. You'll get the news as it's happening from right here at our nation's capital in Washington, D.C. Thank you all so much for joining us today. Thank you for having my back. Roll the credits.